I am intrigued by history, which I'm sure is not exactly shocking to all of you. Along those lines, my wife Janelle and I had a unique experience this past Sunday evening. She had spotted an announcement about a free event to be held in Cleveland at what's known as the Maltz Performing Arts Center. It's on the campus of Case Western Reserve University. Western Reserve was the name given to Ohio in the early days when it was actually a function and a part of one of the New England states. Was it Connecticut, that owned the land that is now Ohio, and it was known as the Western Reserve of Connecticut. And it later became Ohio, so that's still preserved in the name of the university. It's not far from Severance Hall, the home of the Cleveland Orchestra, with which we're very familiar. One of the world-class orchestras. It's generally rated as top 10 in the world, sometimes top 5. And we've had the opportunity to hear them frequently. The building we were in, the Maltz Performing Arts Center, was built shortly after World War I. It was dedicated in 1923, and it was originally designed as a Jewish temple. And, of course, inside, you would expect there are carvings of the Ten Commandments in Hebrew and various Star of David memorabilia and so on throughout the building, because that's how it was constructed almost 100 years ago. The event we attended was entitled The Children of Wilsden Lane, W-I-L-L-E-S-D-E-N. It's a small street in the north of London. We couldn't really determine if it was a concert or a lecture or exactly what it was. In fact, we just didn't really know. My wife, I'm not sure what drew her attention to it, whether the part about performing arts center or concert or free. Maybe it was all of those things. We only knew that it had something to do with what was called the Kindertransport, which was a series of trains taking Austrian Jewish children who were endangered by the Nazi regime that had taken over, first to the coast of northern France and then to England to be cared for by English families so that they could escape Austria after the 1938 Anschluss, which is the German word for union, by which basically Nazi Germany annexed Austria in 1938. It turns out that the event was both a concert and a lecture, and it was more than that. The presenter was a Grammy-winning concert pianist by the name of Mona Golubek. She was also, as we found, a storyteller of the first order. She blended her presentation with both music and personal history, but very personal because the core of her presentation was about her mother, whose name was Lisa Jura, J-U-R-A. Lisa Jura was a 14-year-old Austrian Jewess living in Vienna in 1938 with her family. Her parents were Abraham and Malka Jura. Her father was a tailor, a very gifted tailor, and her mother was also a concert pianist who taught her. She had another teacher, and that was woven into the story as well after the Anschluss, when Austrians who were non-Jewish were forbidden to have contact with, or in this case, teach Jewish piano students. We were very moved by the presentation. It was one about hardship and terrible disruption, but also amazing success. She interspersed it with clips from the various music pieces that had meant a lot to her mother and to herself. Grieg's Piano Concerto, foremost among them, which is a very difficult piece. There aren't that many who can play it well. I know one lady who can, but there aren't too many that do that so well. This lady was quite clearly a gifted pianist. We were just taken by her story about how her mother survived and was cared for in a home with 31 other young refugees. She was to be greeted by an uncle who immediately told her that he and his family were moving to the country to a very small house and had no room for her, but that she would be taken care of by the society that was placing children. She was initially placed in what she thought was a castle, but it was rather a hardship kind of case where the treatment of the young people was not very good, so she packed up and left and went back to the agency and informed them that she expected to be placed in somewhere else where she would be better cared for. And she could play the piano, by the way. Thank you very much. So it was quite the story. Because her father was a tailor, she was placed in a home with 31 other Jewish refugee children and given a job in a sewing factory where they were making uniforms for the war effort. But because of her skills, she would play the piano at night. There was a grand piano in the home where she was, and she would play in the evenings during the air raids until an air raid bomb struck very close and pretty much destroyed the home. It was rebuilt. None of the children were killed. No one was killed, remarkably. But it's the whole story made for such a fascinating, fascinating tale. As it turns out, her younger sister, her father was, of course, unable to work. He had a tailoring business, but he was a Jew, so the businesses were forbidden. And the family didn't understand why he had taken to playing cards for money in the evenings until he came home one night severely beaten. He happened to be out the night of the Kristallnacht, the night of the broken windows, where Jewish businesses and homes were attacked and the windows were smashed and they were beaten. He came home severely beaten, but he held out in his hand, he had something in his hand, and he showed his wife and his three daughters. It was a ticket, one ticket on the Kinder transport to safety in England for one of the three daughters. They decided it would be Lisa, the 14-year-old in the middle. Her older sister was 17, her younger sister was 12. And Lisa went to England. This was 1938. As it turned out, her younger sister managed to get one more ticket on the Kinder transport, and her younger sister was taken to safety on the last train to safely leave Austria. Her parents, Abraham and Malka Jura, and her older sister, Rosie, were taken to Auschwitz. Her parents were murdered, did not survive the war, but her sister survived. And when Lisa was accepted into the Royal Conservatory of Music training program in London and eventually had her debut in Wigmore Hall in London after the war, playing Grieg's Piano Concerto, both of her sisters were there. It's quite a remarkable, remarkable story. And we, of course, had to order the book because I want to find out a little more detail about it. The Children of Willesden Lane. You know, there have been so many other fascinating things to learn, some from our experiences, like that one, others gleaned from our travels, many from books. Another one that will always stand out for me personally is from a book titled The Day the World Came to Town. The subtitle is 911 in Gander, Newfoundland. It was a book we found in a store in St. John's, Newfoundland, on one of our travels, and I, of course, had to buy it. And Gander is about a three-hour drive north from St. John's, where we visit when we go to Newfoundland. It has a large runway because it's a former military base. It's a U.S. air base originally. It has an airstrip capable of landing commercial airliners. A holdover from earlier times, both military and commercial, because in the early days of commercial flight, planes didn't have the range to clear the Atlantic. And so in many cases, they had to take hops, shorter hops, to refuel. And Gander, Newfoundland was often a last refueling stop before crossing the Atlantic or the first one coming back from Europe in earlier days. But it hadn't been used in that way for many years. Most of you, I think, will probably recall 911 very clearly, another day etched into our memory. But let me make the observation that unless you are at least in your mid-20s or late 20s, you have no recollection of it. Because we just celebrated the 20th, I don't know if celebrate is the right word, noted the 20th anniversary of September the 11th, 2001. Hard to believe it's been 20 years. Since that day, which is, again, etched in many of our memories. On that day, when the terrorists attacked by commandeering four planes with evil intent to use them as weapons against this country, for the first time in aviation history, all U.S. airspace was closed to non-military traffic. All commercial and private aircraft in the skies were commanded to land as soon as possible at whatever airfield was close and could handle the traffic. And in a minor miracle, there was not one single air mishap on that day in getting all those planes out of the air safely. The military was given orders to shoot down any unresponsive and unidentified aircraft, even if the aircraft was a commercial airliner or a private plane. If it didn't respond to instructions, they were to shoot it out of the skies. Because, of course, in the early stages, there was no way to know which commercial airliners were, in that sense, legitimate and which ones were terrorist tools by that time. Several flights were on their way to this country from Europe. Those inbound flights nearing North America, passing what they might call the point of no return, were instructed to land in Canadian airports, or if they could, if they hadn't gone too far, to turn around and go back to Europe. 38 of those commercial flights, with 6,595 passengers and crew, landed in Gander, Newfoundland, population 10,000. 6,595, 70%, 65% of the population of the town just landed. The story of how that small city and the surrounding towns housed and fed and cared for those people over the next week until U.S. airspace reopened is heartwarming. There were friendships formed, relationships formed, people simply opened their homes and said, you need a shower? The house is open. There are, towels in the linen closet. Help yourself. It was just an astonishing thing. There's even a touring off-Broadway musical production that's been crafted about it. It's titled Come From Away, which is a unique Newfie expression. It just means you're not from Newfoundland. When we were last there, not quite 2 years ago, in January of 2020, when I conducted the funeral for Blanche Smith, the wife of our elder David Smith, a very delightful older lady came up to my wife after the service, and she asked my wife, she said, have you come from away, dear? So my wife knew exactly how to answer. Yes, I've come from away. Of course, for my wife and me, underlying any and all talk of historical and maybe prophetic events is the trip we took over 2 years ago to Israel. And I'm looking at a few travelers here as well. But there's something else in common with these two stories that I've mentioned. They both involve an alignment of religious forces and political forces in our world that are in so many ways foreign to us. How do you understand the mind of a terrorist? How do you understand what happened in Germany in the 1930s and 40s? We can't comprehend it in our world. But could those strange alignments gather steam and move into unexpected patterns in a world we think we know? It happened in the 1930s. There is one key source we can check, of course, and it has some interesting things to tell us. It's God's view of what lies ahead. Do you know what that is? Where is our world now? Not 73 years ago, 1938, in Vienna, Austria. Not 20 years ago, in the northeastern United States, in New York City or Washington, D.C., or in a tiny little town called Shanksville, Pennsylvania. But now, right now, what lies in the future? More space flights? We now have commercial flights into suborbital space. I'm sure you have enough, just petty cash lying around to shell out the multiple thousands of dollars if you want to take a flight into suborbital space. Personally, not interested. Although there was a time when I was younger that I thought being an astronaut would be kind of cool. But that was when I saw John Glenn circle the Earth 3 times in Friendship 7, and I was a much younger person. You know, William Shatner recently rode one of those flights, and so finally he could say, "Beam me up, Scotty." And they did. He's 90 years old. Tragically, one of his fellow travelers, Glenn DeVries, was killed 2 days ago in a light plane crash in New Jersey. 49 years old. The irony, he went on a suborbital flight into the edges of space, and he dies in a private plane crash in New Jersey just 2 days ago at the age of 49. Life is rather unpredictable sometimes, isn't it? But what about those other stories I talked about earlier? What about the dark side of human nature? For all the heartwarming stories that Mona Golubek shared with us about her mother's life, or the ones that came out of Gander, Newfoundland in 2001, there's the other side. After all, why was it necessary to have a Kinder transport to help threatened Jewish children get out of Austria, pulling them from their families? In many cases, they never saw them again. Lisa Jura's mother, Malka, took her face in her hands and said, "My music will be with you." And that was the last time she ever saw her mother. Mona's grandmother. Mona never met her grandmother, of course. She just heard the stories and saw the pictures. Why was it necessary for a tiny town in Newfoundland to care for over 6,000 people who simply landed at their airport one day? And it took a while to sort out the security arrangements there because it wasn't known yet. Would one of those commercial airliners have terrorists on board? They didn't know. They had to go slowly. It was hours before they could all get off the planes. Well, brethren, the answer to those things is because of the evil in human hearts that murdered 10 million people in the Holocaust, 6 million of them Jews, or 3,000 people on September the 11th, 2001. Which one will triumph? Which side of human nature? The kindness and the courage and the bravery, or the evil? Or is there more to it than that? You know, historically, we seem to craft our recollections of our culture and events looking at national and military and maybe commercial trends. That's in our Western world. In the Western world, we pay very little attention anymore to religion. It's become sort of a backup. I heard a poll recently that mentioned that in this country, the relative, I guess you'd call it trustworthiness or seeking someone whose advice you would turn to, the relative trustworthiness of clergymen has now fallen to the levels where it's approaching that of lawyers. Mr. Henderson didn't much care for that in Cleveland this morning when I mentioned it, for those of you who know him. But that's our Western world. I couldn't help but think in those terms this past Sunday, listening to the story of young Lisa Jura in Austria and eventually England and eventually, in 1949, the United States, where she immigrated with her husband. She married a decorated French resistance fighter from World War II, and they immigrated to the United States where they had 2 daughters, Mona and Renee, who are both concert pianists, as their mother was, and their grandmother before them. In that list I gave you, maybe we should include religious trends in that list, not just national or military or commercial, because that's another area that figures in. It's just we pay no attention to it in the Western world. In fact, that's what 9-1-1 was all about at its core, wasn't it? Killing the infidels. Radical Islam. Radical Islam's hatred of the West, what impact will it all play in our world going forward? And wasn't the Holocaust about hatred toward another ethnic group and singling them out? My wife and I visited Yad Vashem, so did the Kuntz, and others of you may have as well. It's incredibly sobering and just heart-tuggingly, heart-rendingly sad. Using the term the West leads us to talk about East versus West. And we do it that way in religion too, don't we? Let me show you what I mean. Let me just list some religions for you. And if you're taking notes, write down whether you consider that religion to be an Eastern religion or a Western religion. Catholicism, Eastern or Western? Hinduism, Eastern or Western? Buddhism, Eastern or Western? Protestantism, Eastern or Western? Islam, Eastern or Western? That one's a little more difficult, isn't it? The influence of Islam is growing in many areas of the world. By and large, we think of the world of Christianity, and I would sort of put that in quotes, nominal or traditional Christianity, as Western, don't we, in religion? And non-Christian religions we tend to lump all together and call them Eastern. The reality is it's not quite that simple. Some realigning of our world may yet be ahead of us, and religion at some point is going to be a factor. Turn to Daniel 11, and I'll show you what I mean. I was watching Mr. Roop very closely, and as far as I could tell, he drank from both of these glasses. No. I don't think he drank from either one. I'm going to take a chance. Daniel 11. It's the longest single prophecy in the Bible, and it details events in a very specific focus over a period of several years, decades, centuries, in fact. And it speaks of something about somebody magnifying himself above every god, speaking blasphemies in verse 36, not regarding the God of his fathers, any god, a god of fortresses, verse 38. And then in verse 40, it says, at the time of the end, the king of the south shall attack this other person. And the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind, with chariots, horsemen, and many ships. And he shall enter the countries, overwhelm them, and pass through. As a side note, back in the 1930s, a brand new radio program that was called The World Tomorrow was watching events, and the presenter warned about the movement of troops when Ethiopia was attacked by Italy, fascist Italy. But then it became apparent that these verses did not apply because, as you read verse 41, he comes with chariots, horsemen, ships. He'll enter the countries, pass through. He'll enter the glorious land. That didn't happen. And so it wasn't about the 30s and the 40s. It was yet a prophecy. And many countries shall he be overthrown, but these shall escape from his hand, Edom, Moab, and the prominent people of Ammon. He shall stretch out his hand against the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. He shall have power over the treasures of gold and silver and over all the precious things of Egypt. Also the Libyans and Ethiopians shall follow at his heels. But news from the east and the north shall trouble him. Therefore he shall go out with great fury to destroy and annihilate many. And he shall plant the tents of his palace between the seas and the glorious holy mountain. Yet he shall come to his end, and no one will help him. What's that all about? Do you remember those verses? Have you read them, studied them, pondered them? It's interesting, isn't it, that what we see happening religiously before our eyes in the last 20 years or so, since 9/11, is a realigning of the religious world into a north-south contrast, rather than the east-west one we're so familiar with. Is it out of the question that religion could once again begin to dominate headlines? We've had some serious issues with Islamic radicals attacking within Europe in different places, England, Italy, France, so many of these places. Now, they're just sort of little independent radical cells now, but it's a north-south alignment. not east-west. Is it out of the question that religion could once again begin to dominate headlines? We tend to ignore it in our world, our Western world. And I don't mean the declining influence of religion in the life of the average Westerner. Like I said, you know, the clergy is descending in order of reliability and dependability and relevance in our world. That's a factor too, but it's not the North-South realignment I'm talking about. If we're talking about the radical elements of Islam, it already has begun to dominate headlines. It didn't start with 9-1-1, and it certainly didn't end with it. The source of the ultimate conflict leading up to the return of Jesus Christ will probably have many factors. And of course, our trip to Israel brought some of that powerfully to mind. We've seen pressure on European nations from the oil-producing states of the Middle East as one factor. Isn't that a southern element pushing at a northern element? I think it is. Dictating political policy, holding them over a barrel, literally, of oil. We see tensions escalating with various nations in the Middle East, Iraq, Iran, others, Afghanistan, of course, the U.S. pulling out of Afghanistan, let alone Israel. What's all that mean? What else will be shaping events in the end time? Take a look at 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. And verse 1. Now, brethren, concerning the coming of our Lord Jesus Christ, that's known as, its Greek word is parousia, the second coming or the appearance, and our gathering together to him, we ask you not to be soon shaken in mind or troubled, either by spirit or by word or by letter, as if from us, as though the day of Christ had come. Let no one deceive you by any means, for that day will not come first, or not come unless the falling away comes first, and the man of sin is revealed, the son of perdition, who opposes and exalts himself above all that is called God or that is worshipped, so that he sits as God in the temple of God, showing himself that he is God. Now, that seems outrageous to us, and it has overtones of Daniel 11. We can't imagine. I mean, what if somebody came up to you and just informed you with a straight face and said, I'm Jesus Christ? What would you say? What would you do? Well, as soon as you could, you'd probably call somebody. The police? A mental health facility? Something. Because we couldn't take that seriously. We might wonder if this person had a mental illness and was at some, you know, risk to himself or herself or others, because nobody would take that seriously. You're not Jesus Christ. But here's somebody who apparently, you know, exactly how these words are to be taken, but some of the references in Daniel make it sound like somebody is virtually wanting to be worshipped in some fashion. It's hard to fathom in our world now. Religion doesn't occupy such a central place in the Western world. People don't pay very much attention to it, except for platitudes and holidays and gifts. There are several factors here. First of all, for one thing, we find in these verses, the body of believers itself must first experience a falling away. It doesn't say great falling away. Sometimes I've heard messages that way, but the word great doesn't appear. It just says a falling away or the falling away. 30 years ago in the Church of God, we might have had trouble understanding that. We no longer have any trouble. But even then, I've seen some statistics from in the early 90s covering a span of years in what was then the Worldwide Church of God, first the Radio Church of God at its inception in 1934, about those who remained in the church after a certain number of years. And whether we realized it or not, the statistics in the early 90s were that of all those who were members of, at that time, the Worldwide Church of God, that the, I guess you'd call it the recidivism rate, those who stayed, was about 62 to 65%. About 3 in every 8 who had ever been members of the Worldwide Church of God and who were still living in the early 90s were no longer in the church. They'd left. So even in those days, even before the middle 90s, by the late 80s and early 90s, we still had lost about 3 out of every 8 who had ever been in the church. 5 out of 8 or so had stayed. We don't have, of course, enough years and track record to repeat those statistics now with any degree of reliability, because that requires years of stats. And the various branches of the Church of God would make it even more complicated. But we don't have any trouble understanding now the concept of a falling away. There's more. There's something on the world scene itself. There's a man of sin described here who, as ludicrous as it sounds to us, apparently will actually claim to be God, or at least certainly God's special agent of some sort. And to us now in the Western world, that just sounds nuts. But apparently there's coming a time where he'll be taken seriously. Why is that? We're looking at it from Western secular eyes. Our culture is secular. I think we would all understand that. It doesn't pay a whole lot of attention to religious direction and themes anymore. Lip service, yes. Actual directions, no. Look at verse 9, where the aid will come from to assist this person carry this off. It says, the coming of the lawless one is according to the working of Satan, with all power, signs, and lying wonders. That's astonishing. We're not talking parlor tricks. We're not talking reaching behind somebody's ear and hauling out, you know, a quarter and saying, boy, I didn't know you had money in your hair. We're not talking little magic tricks. We're talking miraculous events. That's going to be convincing. One of the stories that came out of last Sunday night was when Mona Golubac told the story of her mother going to her piano lesson, taking the trolley, and getting to her teacher's apartment and finding that there was a Nazi soldier guarding it. And he challenged her and didn't want to let her in. He said, what are you doing here? She said, I have a piano lesson. And he said, schnell, you know, quickly get upstairs. Well, she went in and knocked and went into the apartment, the door, the studio with where this instructor also lived. There was no one there in the parlor where the piano was, so she sat down to play. And as she was playing, her teacher came out of his room, his private room, and she waited, but he didn't sit down on the bench beside her like he always did to teach her and guide her through. And finally, she finished, and he said, Lisa, I'm sorry. I'm not a brave man. And this won't be our last lesson because I'm not allowed to teach Jewish students anymore. I'm sorry. There can be coercion that is very hard to resist. And we wonder where things will go in the future. This gives us a clue. Is Satan clever? Yes, he is. We find in Revelation 12:9, as you're very familiar, that he's deceived the whole world. I won't turn there. Is he powerful? Yes, of course he is, within limits, with whatever God allows. Is he deceptive? That's his entire nature. Could he deceive you or me? Well, what did Paul write to the Thessalonians in verse 3? He wrote to our brothers and sisters in the faith in the first century, let no one deceive you by any means. Are we better than they? I don't think so. Don't forget verse 3. It doesn't say the falling away will all be accomplished in one moment, does it? Even though we tend to think of it that way. That's why I mentioned the statistics. It was a gradual process of people coming in the front door and leaving by the back door anyway. Turn to Revelation 3, but keep your place in 2 Thessalonians because we'll be back here a number of times. Revelation chapter 13. In You have no idea what a remarkable thing it is for me to say, hold your place. Usually I remember it after I've already told you where to go next, and you've forgotten, and you took your finger out, and you didn't have a bookmark. No charge for that extra service today. Revelation 13, verse 11. I saw another beast coming up out of the earth. This is the description of what we would call the final resurrection of the beast power, a series of revivals of the Holy Roman Empire from early days in the first century. And it says, he had two horns like a lamb and spoke like a dragon. A beast who looks like a lamb. Who is the most consequential lamb of the Bible? It's the Lamb of God, isn't it? Jesus Christ. Who is the dragon? We know that too. So he pretends to look like Christ, but he speaks like Satan. And he exercises all the authority of the first beast in his presence. There's one beast that is civil and one beast that is religious. And those who dwell in it to worship the first beast whose deadly wound was healed. He performs great signs so that he makes fire come down from heaven on the earth in the sight of men. And he deceives those who dwell on earth by those signs which he was granted to do in the sight of the beast, telling those who dwell on the earth to make an image to the beast who was wounded by the sword and lived. He was granted power to give breath to the image of the beast, that the image of the beast should both speak and cause as many as would not worship that image to be killed. It goes on. We'll get back to that in a moment. Sounds remarkably like the description Paul gave in 2 Thessalonians, didn't it? And overtones of Daniel 11. You know, they have descriptions. Also, go further to chapter 16 of Revelation. Hopefully your finger is still in 2 Thessalonians 2. Revelation 16, verses 13 and 14, I saw three unclean spirits like frogs coming out of the mouth of the dragon, out of the mouth of the beast, and out of the mouth of the false prophet. So these are unclean spirits. They're like demonic influences, one from directly from Satan, one from this civil beast power, and one from the false religious power. They are spirits of demons performing signs which go out to the kings of the earth and of the whole world to gather them to the battle of the great day of God Almighty. They convince people to fight against the returning Jesus Christ. In Israel, 2.5 years ago, we stood on Mount Carmel. There was a viewing stand. There was an extended walkway, patio type thing where you could gaze out over the Jezreel Valley. And we could see the vastness of it where huge armies could gather and prepare to move against Jerusalem to the south and east. We were also near Tel Megiddo on that trip, or Har Megiddo, or Armageddon, as you might more commonly recognize it. Back to John's vision. This is going to appear to the world to be a kind of a new religious movement. Nothing like this exists today, and yet it will be very old. It will shock people. They will marvel at what it has accomplished, including how fast it seemed to come out of nowhere. Look at Revelation 17, verse 7. But the angel said to me, "Why did you marvel? I will tell you the mystery of the woman and of the beast that carries her, which has the 7 heads and the 10 horns. The beast that you saw was and is not." In other words, it used to exist, but it's not visible now. But it will ascend out of the bottomless pit, or out of this abyss where it seems to have been destroyed historically. But it's going to perdition. That's where the end of it is. And those who dwell on the earth will marvel, whose names were not written in the book of life from the foundation of the world, when they see the beast that was and is not, and yet it is. It has come out of nowhere. It seems like a brand new power, but it's a very old one. What will the world scene seem to be like, at least to those who don't resist this powerful influence? Turn to chapter 18 of Revelation. You'll see what drives the connection. The kings of the earth, verse 9, who committed fornication and lived luxuriously with her, will weep and lament when they see the smoke of her burning, standing at a distance for fear of her torment, saying, "Alas, alas, that great city Babylon, that mighty city, in 1 hour your judgment has come." It seemed to come out of nowhere, and it disappears almost as fast. And the merchants of the earth will weep and mourn over her, for nobody buys their merchandise anymore. It's driven by economics. What drives our world? Have you seen some of the reports about a word that you probably don't remember hearing for like 30 years? Inflation. Heard that lately? Consumer price indexes have risen over 6% in this country in the last year. We haven't had that hit since the early 90s. Gasoline costs 50% more in this country than it did a year ago. Bacon costs 20% more. You might want to cut back on your bacon in the morning. Milk, 15 to 20%. Used cars, 26%. We know about that because we just recently had to replace our vehicle. 26% increase. Just think what we could have gotten it for a year ago. But we didn't know. We didn't know. It goes on to say, all the merchants of the earth will weep and mourn. No one buys their merchandise. Merchandise of gold, silver, stones, pearls, linen, purple, silk, scarlet, every kind of citron wood. Objects of ivory, objects of most precious wood, bronze, iron, and marble. Cinnamon, incense, fragrant oil, frankincense, wine, oil, fine flour, wheat, cattle, sheep, horses, chariots, bodies, and souls of men. What does that mean? Is it a trade in slaves? Is it captivity? Could it be both? The fruit that your soul longed for has gone from you. All the things that are rich and splendid have gone. You'll find them no more. The merchants of these things who became rich will stand at a distance for fear of her torment. That seems to be a common element. Stay way away from her. We don't want to be caught with a fire. Weeping and wailing, alas, alas, the great city clothed in fine linen, purple, scarlet, adorned with gold, gold, precious stones, pearls, the wealth. In 1 hour, such great riches came to nothing. Every shipmaster, all who traveled by ship, sailors, as many as trade on the sea, stood at a distance and cried out when they saw the smoke of her burning. What is like this great city? They threw dust on their heads, indicative of mourning. And they cried out, weeping and wailing, alas, that great city in which all who had ships on the sea became rich by her wealth. In 1 hour, she's made desolate. Here's the flip side. Rejoice over her, O heaven, and you holy apostles and prophets, for God has avenged you on her. Quite a story. Quite a story. How many references there are to wealth. And any who resist, which we were just about to read in chapter 13, are cut out of the wealth, what's called the mark of the beast in Revelation 13, verses 15 to 17. Obviously, there is nothing like that on the scene now because we don't have a beast power on the scene. So you can't very well have the mark of the beast when the beast isn't here yet. Not to mention the fact that the setting is Europe, not the United States. And we'll see where it spreads from there. Does it all seem confusing? Again, still holding your place in 2 Thessalonians 2, go to Matthew 24. And I promise you, we will go back to 2 Thessalonians 2. I'm not just giving you an exercise in maintaining flexibility in your digits. Matthew 24. He sat on the Mount of Olives, verse 3. The disciples came to him and said, "Tell us, when will these things be?" The business about not one stone left on another, etc. "What will be the sign of your coming, the end of the age?" And Jesus answered and said, what's his first thing out of his mouth? "Take heed that no one deceives you." First thing out of his mouth. "For many will come in my name, saying I am the Christ, and will deceive many." So we're not talking about the man of sin at the end who is so swell-headed he thinks he is God or next thing to it. We're talking about people who come and want to talk to you about Jesus. We were having breakfast the other day in a restaurant not far from where we live with the Patchingers, Mr. and Mrs. Al Patchinger, Al and Pauline Patchinger, one of the elders in Cleveland. And a gentleman came around to the table and asked if we were all Christians. had a whole stack of little tracts in his hand. We said, yes. Well, he started in on, and finally, Mr. Patchinger and I looked at each other. It was like, are you going to do it or am I going to do it? Finally, I said, well, we are actually both elders. In fact, I'm a pastor myself. Oh, is that right? Well, good for you. And then he went to the next table and didn't leave us any of his little tracts or literature. And Mr. Patchinger and I looked at each other and grinned. I said, that could have gone very badly wrong, but I thought I'd take a shot. I am the Christ. They don't mean they are. They mean they're talking about him, saying he's the Messiah. But they don't tell you what he said to do or how to live. They just talk about him all the time. And then he gets into the wars and rumors of wars and all the rest of it. Sounds like a very confusing time with cross currents religiously. Verse 24 and 25, it says, false Christs and false prophets will rise and show great signs and wonders to deceive, if possible, even the elect. And he says, I have warned you. See, I have told you beforehand. Confusing. It's interesting, isn't it? Many times in man's history, he has thought he could just dispense with God or what God said at the start, ignore it. Lately, in the last 150, 200 years or so, he thought he could get rid of God himself completely. It didn't exist. You ever heard the name of the French or the German philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche or Nietzsche? Yeah. He died in 1900, so if you don't remember him, I understand. But he's one of the main innovators behind the 19th century movement, God is Dead. Talk about arrogance. One of the cleverest T-shirts I've seen, you know, T-shirts with messages. This one had a quote, and the person who said the quote and the T-shirt said, Nietzsche is dead, God. Yep, he is. And God's still here. But there's something in the human mind that keeps coming back to this search. Ecclesiastes 3. How's your finger in 2 Thessalonians doing? Ecclesiastes 3. This is the famous chapter of a time for every purpose under heaven. To everything there's a season, etc., etc. And of course, Solomon was not in a great place because he was trying to attain satisfaction and happiness with only physical triggers to provide it, and that just wasn't working. And so he says in verse 9, what profit has the worker from that in which he labors? I've seen the God-given task with which the sons of men are to be occupied. He's made everything beautiful in its time. Also, he has put eternity in their hearts, except that no one can find out the work that God does from beginning to end. Interesting phrase. He has put eternity into their hearts. We can comprehend something beyond our own existence, before our existence and after our existence. No other creature can do that. We're unique. And it makes us reach for something more than ourselves. Paul later wrote about if we do not have Christ in this life or God in this life, we are of all men the most pitiable. Unfortunately, there's a great deceptive being standing ready to take advantage of this built-in proclivity in the way God made us. The future, the Bible shows, holds yet another time of terrible upheaval, religious-based as Satan tries again to destroy the potential children of God. So that brings it down to you and to me. Where do we stand on all of this? What will the future mean to us and for us? Satan, as we know, particularly hates those who resist him. There's a passage in Revelation 12 where we believe that it is a reference to the church of God being attacked or persecuted or chased by Satan. And after we find that God helps the woman, as it's called, with a miraculous deliverance, in verse 16 of Revelation 12, the earth helped the woman. The earth opened its mouth and swallowed up the flood which the dragon had spewed out of his mouth. And look at Satan's reaction. The dragon was enraged with the woman. And he went to make war with the rest of her offspring, the ones who keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus Christ. Remember what Jesus himself said on the Sermon on the Mount? Why do you call me Lord, Lord, and do not the things which I say? It's not enough to profess. We have to be obedient to what he said. Why don't you do what I said? He said. These are the ones, they are the remnant of the rest of her offspring who keep God's commandments and have the testimony of Jesus Christ, the witness, the validation of Jesus Christ and who he is, who he was, who he will be when he returns to this earth. How will we be sure that we choose the right path? When a charismatic religious leader of the future, who even has the power to perform miracles, which our media-driven world will probably flash around the globe immediately, how will we make the right choices? When he steps on the world scene and appears to be trying to unite all peoples, how did Hitler deceive the Germans in the 1930s? Well, they got rid of the corruption. They cleaned up the cities. They put on a fake showcase of an Olympics in 1936. They hid all the anti-Jewish propaganda and magazines, cleaned the cities, made it look like just a wonderful place. But behind the scenes, things were building and building and building. What will we do? The mass culture around us will be swayed. That's the picture the Bible paints. It won't seem all that bad at first. Go back to 2 Thessalonians, because Paul's letter to the Thessalonians really holds the answer for us, for you and for me. And that's what I really want to get to today. So now the introduction is over. 2 Thessalonians 2. You know what I did? I took my finger out of 2 Thessalonians and it was looking, Revelation 11 was looking at me. I can find it again though. There it is. 2 Thessalonians 2, verse 9. The coming of the lawless one is according to the working of Satan with all power, signs, lying wonders. And, verse 10, with all unrighteous deception among those who perish or are perishing. Because they did not receive the love of the truth that they might be saved. For this reason, God will send them strong delusion that they should believe the lie. That may be a protection so that their minds are not yet exposed and open to God's truth and their time of understanding is yet ahead. That they all may be condemned or judged who didn't believe the truth but had pleasure in unrighteousness. It wasn't their time yet, perhaps. That would be a kind way to look at that. The most important key that we can know, brethren, and know now, is in here. Do you see it? Let me ask a question. Is it important to know the truth? Well, of course it is. Hold your place in 2 Thessalonians and go back to Romans 10. Romans 10, verse 14. Verse 13 is a verse repeated very frequently in traditional Christianity. Whoever calls on the name of the Lord shall be saved. See, that's all you have to do is call on the name of the Lord, give your heart to the Lord. If you want, your pocketbook to the preacher and you'll be saved. How then shall they call on him in whom they've not believed? There's more to it. And how shall they believe in him of whom they've not heard? And how shall they hear without a preacher? And how shall they preach unless they're sent? As it's written, how beautiful are the feet of those who preach the gospel of peace, who bring glad tidings of good things. The truth is important. And it has to be supplied by those who have been commissioned to do it by God. It's delivered by his messengers, including, of course, his written word. Where does it come from? Is there more? Is there more that's important besides just knowing the truth? Well, yes, there is. Turn to Romans chapter 6, back up a few pages. Verse 16. Do you not know that to whom you present yourselves slaves to obey, Paul writes, You are that one, slaves, whom you obey, whether of sin leading to death or of obedience leading to righteousness. But God be thanked that though you were slaves of sin, yet you obeyed from the heart that form of doctrine to which you were delivered. And having been set free from sin, you became slaves of righteousness. I speak in human terms because of the weakness of your flesh. Just as you presented your members as slaves of uncleanness and lawlessness, leading to more lawlessness, so now present your members as slaves of righteousness for holiness. For when you were slaves of sin, you were free in regard to righteousness. What fruit did you have then, it says? In the things of which you are now ashamed. But, it says, the end of those things is death. Having been set free, and so on, become slaves of God, you have your fruit to holiness, and the end, everlasting life. And then the familiar verse, the wages of sin is death. The gift of God is eternal life in Christ Jesus. Something else is important. In addition to the truth, obedience. Obedience. Israel, as a nation, were given God's laws. They were given the truth. They had it thundered from Mount Sinai. They heard the words. What was their reaction? Don't let him talk to us again. Moses, you go up there. He can blast you out of existence, but not us. Don't make us listen again. You tell us and we'll pay attention to you, right? Is there more? There is. Go back to 2 Thessalonians 2 and read it again. Knowledge is necessary. It is not enough. Obedience is necessary. That too by itself is not enough. Verse 10 of 2 Thessalonians 2, it says, with all unrighteous deception among those who perish because they did not receive the love of the truth that they might be saved. Do you love God's truth? Do I love God's truth? Can I envision my life without it? Could anything make me surrender it and give it up? God is building his family. That family must learn to think like he does. That means not only knowing, not only obeying. It goes without saying that if our lives are patterns of ignorance or disobedience, we won't be there, but it goes beyond. But loving what we know and what we're doing in our obedience. That means we will adopt as our own the very character of God. It's interesting. In Revelation 19, keep your place in 2 Thessalonians 2. Revelation 19 and verses 7 and 8, the description of the return of Jesus Christ. Let us be glad and rejoice and give him glory. For the marriage of the Lamb has come and his wife has made herself ready. To her it was granted to be arrayed in fine linen, clean and bright. For the fine linen is the righteous acts of the saints. You ever heard the phrase, clothes make the man or clothes make the woman? It is important in God's eyes. It is important, and in fact, so much so that he characterizes this very special uniform of his people at the return of his son. The fine linen that they wear, that's the righteous acts, the righteousness of my saints. That's a uniform I want to put on. How about you? Let's look at a familiar section of Scripture. Hold your place in 2 Thessalonians 2. In the 119th Psalm, we will not read all of the verses. Psalm 119. But we'll read a few of them. Verse 97, you know how it's a type of poetry. The 119th Psalm. There are 22 letters in the Hebrew alphabet, and there are 22 groupings of 8 verses here, each one headed by a letter of the Hebrew alphabet, if you look in your Bible. This one is the letter Mem. Verse 97, "Oh, how I love your law. It is my meditation all the day. You, through your commandments, make me wiser than my enemies. They're ever with me. I have more understanding than all my teachers. Your testimonies are my meditation. I understand more than the aged ones or the ancients because I keep your precepts. I've restrained my feet from every evil way that I can keep your word. I have not departed from your judgments. You've taught me yourself. How sweet are your words to my taste, sweeter than honey to my mouth. Through your precepts I get understanding, therefore I hate every false way." Back it up to the previous section, beginning in verse 89, Lamed letter. "Forever, O Lord, your word is settled in heaven. Your faithfulness endures to all generations. You establish the earth, it abides. You continue, or they continue this day according to your ordinances. They're all your servants. Unless your law had been my delight, I would have perished in my affliction." My delight. "I will never forget your precepts. You've given them life, given me life by them. I'm yours. Save me. I have sought your precepts. The wicked wait for me to destroy me, but I will give attention to your testimonies. I've seen the consummation of all perfection, but your commandment is exceedingly broad." You go through more and more and more. Verses 105 and on. "Your word is a lamp to my feet. I pray the freewill offerings of my mouth and teach me your judgments. I don't forget your law. The wicked have laid a snare for me. Your testimonies I've taken as a heritage. They're the rejoicing of my heart. I hate the double-minded, but I love your law. You're my hiding place, my shield." I'm just skipping through. It says in verse 121, "I've done justice and righteousness. Don't leave me to my oppressors. Don't let the proud oppress me. My eyes fail from seeking your salvation and your righteous word. Deal with your servant according to your mercy. Teach me your statutes. I am your servant. Give me understanding so that I know your testimonies." Maybe you've prayed the next verse, 126, as I have a few times. "It's time for you to act, O Lord. For they have regarded your law as void. Therefore, I love your commandments more than gold, more than fine gold. All your precepts concerning all things I consider to be right." Drop down to verse 131. "I opened my mouth and panted. I longed for your commandments. Look upon me and be merciful as your custom is toward those who love your name. Direct my steps by your word. Let no iniquity have dominion over me. Don't let me be ruled by sin. Redeem me from the oppression of man that I may keep your precepts. Make your face shine on your servant. Teach me your statutes. Rivers of water run down from my eyes because men do not keep your law." Let me ask you a dumb question. What did David think about God's law and his ways? Did he love them? Did he always keep them perfectly? Oh, no, he had some whoppers. But he repented deeply and came back to God. It's quite a story. Let's go back to 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. I promised. That's not fair. Mr. Koontz has a post-it note stuck in there. I can see these things. Verse 13, "We are bound to give thanks to God always for you, brethren, beloved by the Lord, because God from the beginning chose you for salvation through sanctification by the Spirit and belief in the truth, to which he called you by our gospel for the obtaining of the glory of our Lord Jesus Christ. Therefore, brethren, stand fast. Hold the traditions which you were taught, whether by word or our epistle. Now may our Lord Jesus Christ himself, our God and Father, who has loved us, given us everlasting consolation and good hope by grace, comfort your hearts and establish you in every good word and work." It's quite a letter. Astonishing events happened 73 years ago in Vienna, Austria, in 1938, that my wife and I heard from the daughter of one who lived through them just 6 days ago. And again, more than 20 years ago on 9-1-1, some astonishing events. We remember precisely where we were the first time it came to our attention the planes were flying into the Twin Towers. What about now? Which way will events go as we contemplate the approaching end of yet another calendar year? What will 2022 have in store for us? 2023, 2024. It isn't possible to predict particular events like world-changing wars or terrorist attacks. It's only possible to see where events in the human fabric of history fit into the framework of God's Word and the prophecies of the end time. It's trendy right now in our world, in the Western world, to learn about non-Christian religions because they've impacted our world in such a powerful way. At the same time, traditional Christianity seems to be losing its hold on Westerners. Our world seems headed in diametrically opposite directions based on culture and, yes, even religion. Looking ahead, there could be a powerful Christian backlash to some of this. I put the word Christian in quotes. And there's already a steady growth in Christian denominations, but not here, not in the West. It's in Africa and South and Central America, not so much North America and Europe. All of this may make our world begin to start describing itself in terms of north and south instead of east and west. I wonder. That would fit in with Daniel 11. And perhaps the stage could be getting set for what? We'll need to watch. But what's our most important task? Even the famous verse we turn to in Luke 21, "Watch therefore," what does it talk about? "That you may be counted worthy to escape all these things and to stand before the Son of Man." It doesn't say watch so you know exactly who, you know, comprises the 10 toes of the image of Daniel. It says that you may be counted worthy. Our most important task, brethren, now and always, is knowing, obeying, and loving the truth of God. And that's good, because you see, that we can choose to act on. That's in our control. Unlike the world of Abraham and Malka Jura in 1938 in Vienna, Austria, who desperately wanted to find a way to preserve their three daughters' lives, they could see they might not make it, and they didn't. Astonishingly, all three of their daughters survived. Two of them made it out to England before the war, and the other survived Auschwitz. They had no control over certain things in their life. You and I can control this. It's our choice to know and to obey and to love the truth of God. Think about that as we keep looking forward always to the future that God says will happen.